You are listening to the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast. Hi, this is Shane Vanderhurt. Welcome back to another episode. Today, I want to play you a conversation I had with Steve Reeder. He's a Republican candidate in Iowa's 4th Congressional District. He's the fifth candidate to join that contested primary. You've got four challengers who are trying to keep Congressman Steve King from winning the Republican nomination again. So before we get to that conversation, first a word from our sponsor, American Principles Project.
At American Principles Project, we believe that human dignity should be at the heart of public policy. We work in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. to promote life, religious freedom, local control over education, authentic economic progress for working Americans, and a return to constitutional principles such as federalism. Want to help American Principles Project? Visit our website today, AmericanPrinciplesProject.org. That's AmericanPrinciples, P-L-E-S, project.org. Sign up for email updates. Help us out. We want to work with you. That's AmericanPrinciplesProject.org.
And we're back. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Steve Reeder.
Welcome, Steve, to the Caffeinated Thoughts Podcast. Good to have you on.
Shane, it's great to be here. I appreciate you calling.
So the first thing I ask anybody who is running for office, whether it's at the local level, state level, or even federal, and I've had the opportunity to interview presidential candidates as well, why are you running for office? Why would anyone want to subject themselves to running for office?
Well, Shane, I've been asked that question quite a few times since I've already been on the campaign trail. And I have been in business, in the real estate brokerage and development business for 35 years. I am not a politician. My wife and I have been married for 31 years. We raised two daughters, and we feel that the direction that our country is going with the divisiveness and the getting away from our Constitution and what made this country great has been going in a direction that we're not happy with. So I decided I've got this window of time in my life. I'm going to put my real estate work on pause, and I want to serve and try to stand up for Iowans and the Midwestern values that we all treasure and stand up for our Constitution. And those are things that I'm passionate about. And I want to serve and represent Northwest Iowa on a federal level.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about your background, your business, your time in the district, your family,
okay,
et cetera.
Okay, we've owned this home here in Arnold's Park for 15 years. I was born and raised in Omaha, Nebraska. My mother grew up on a farm in Southwest Iowa, small farm. My grandparents raised six children there, my aunts and uncles. My wife is from Pocahontas County.
Okay.
A lot of her extended family still lives down there. And since I had a newspaper route when I was 14 years old and worked at the Omaha Stockyards and detasseled corn and worked all through college during summers painting houses and installing irrigation systems before I got into the real estate business. I have always worked for myself or on an independent basis. I've over the years, my 35 years in real estate, I've had to deal with all types of businesses, small and large, and small businesses, corporations, and have seen what they have experienced through regulation and hiring employees. And I feel like I've learned a lot about what businesses experience. I've learned a lot about negotiation. Being an independent contractor in real estate, I wasn't able to feed my family unless I went out and made deals. So I've learned a lot about negotiation and writing contracts. And I feel that with this divisiveness in Washington, that I could try to offer some of my experience in negotiation to try and solve some of the problems that are we see going on in Washington right now. So.
Right. So, okay. You are entering into what's now going to be a five-way primary. What sets you apart from the other challengers with Steve King, and what makes you, what do you think, why do you think you would be the best person to run against? Probably J.D. Shulton, I think, is going to probably end up being the Democratic nominee. He's the only one that's actually jumped into the race on the Democrat side so far.
Right. Correct. Well, first of all, I'm not a politician, and I would be using my business experience to go to Washington, and I would think I would be able to walk across the aisle and deal with both sides. I would welcome the opportunity, just like I walk into the coffee shops and the Rotary clubs and the meetings throughout the 4th District. I would have no problem walking into the office of somebody, whether a Democrat or Republican, that maybe has a controversial issue and trying to negotiate a deal and making a deal rather than pitting one side against the other. So okay. I feel like my business experience of 35 years could be put to work trying to solve some of these issues that are facing our country right now.
And we do seem to be pretty polarized. Where do you think some areas of common ground might be?
Well, one thing I'm hearing, Shane, whether it's Republicans or Democrats, is, and it's first and foremost on my list of items I want to tackle, is balancing the budget. Mm-hmm. And I hear that from everyone. Most households live within their means, and the federal government should be required to do the same. And for example, one solution was proposed by Rand Paul called the Penny Plan. Mm-hmm. And basically he has proposed reducing the federal budget by 2% per year, and it would, according to his calculations, would balance the budget within 5 years. So I see no reason why we can't come together, Democrats and Republicans, and start reducing the budget. And I think in Rand Paul's plan has been turned down in 2018. It was turned down again, I think, in May or June of 2019. And those are things that I'm hearing from constituents that should be done.
Yeah,
that's one example.
It seems like, unfortunately, nobody wants to address the debt. Democrats, even Republicans, even President Trump. So how would you be able to cut through the noise and actually get something done when it seems like, you know, everybody's focused on other issues other than this big looming, you know, it's really the big elephant in the room that everybody's ignoring.
Right. Right. Well, I feel, Shane, that our government has just grown way too large. I mean, you've got, you know, you heard some of the presidential candidates over the last 10 years, mostly conservative Republican candidates, you know, talking about some of these, actually eliminating some of these large departments. I've encountered some government bloat just in my business. Just one small example would be like, you know, the Corps of Engineers. When I read the mission statement for the Corps of Engineers, it was set up to protect our coastal waterways and our navigable rivers. years, and it's grown so large that now it's trying to control, you know, the corner of a Northwest Island farmer's farm ground. And, you know, it's gotten so large that some of these offices make business for themselves just to keep their offices staffed. Another example, I'm big on education. One of my daughters is an educator. My wife's got two cousins that are educators. Her uncle was the superintendent of schools up here in Dickinson County.
Okay.
And I feel that we've got this Department of Education that spends, at a federal level, that spends $68 billion a year, when I don't even know if we need that. I mean, I think that on a local and state level, the superintendents and the principals and the teachers can handle that. And I feel that we've gotten away from some of the core education for our kids. I feel like we need to get more civics back into the classroom, and just some core reading, writing, and mathematics. When my kids were being raised, my wife was very involved in their education. You know, she was pushing things like Spalding phonics and Saxton math and just really core pieces of education. And that's one thing that I feel we could spend that money as, if the money is going to be spent, rather than having bureaucrats in Washington trying to tell people how to educate kids, this money should be spent helping to educate good teachers and paying them well. And so anyhow, I guess I'm kind of got off on a couple tangents there, but
that's all right. Education policy is kind of my about. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I feel that education is so important, and I don't think our teachers are getting paid enough, and there's not enough of them. On one of my stops here just a week ago, I met three teachers. Two of them happen to be from Minnesota, but one of them is from Iowa. But they're, have too many kids in the classroom. They're struggling just to keep up with their curriculum because there aren't enough teachers. And, I don't have all the answers other than we have to incentivize them, and those that are doing well need to be on some type of a merit program, be paid according to what they're doing. So,
let me.
And I don't know if go ahead, Shane.
Yeah, so we'll stay on, drill down on education a little bit here. You're running for Congress education is historically a local and state issue, what do you see the federal
right.
role being? Because you're talking about teacher pay and all that. I just want to know where the feds
right.
fall in your mind.
Well, I would get rid of the Department of Education and just, I don't think they need to be involved. I think it should be a local and state level department. I think it's just another example of federal spending that can be cut or reduced.
Since you and I both know that's probably never going to happen.
Right.
That's my dream. I'd love to see that happen. But you don't even have not all Republicans even agree with that. So it's
right.
In our lifetimes, it will probably never happen. What can be done?
Right.
What do you think could be done realistically to limit, to roll back some of the federal role in education?
Well, I would think that we, taking baby steps, just start using some of those funds to get them to a local or state level so that they can start working on getting good teachers, paying them well, maybe helping with some of their student debt, whether it be maybe if they, let's just say a teacher walks away from a four-year university with, you know, $30,000 to $75,000 in debt, maybe if they go into teaching and stay there for 5 years, maybe some portion of their debt be removed, use federal funds for something like that to incentivize good teachers to get into teaching. You know, you and I probably know that most teachers get into it because they love children and they want to educate them. They obviously don't do it for the money, but they need to be paid well so that they can, you know, afford, you know, to have a home and a car and get to school every day. And so, right. Go ahead.
Yeah. I guess this really is more of a state and local issue. I mean, define what paid well mm-hmm. is because obviously, you know, the pay varies by school district. Also, too,
right.
It seems school finance is just, it's a mess. And there's probably a lot of waste at the, you know, I know the trajectory of hiring, school districts hiring non-teaching staff has increased, while the, you know, hiring teaching staff hasn't necessarily increased. So you have a higher,
right.
Higher non-teaching staff to teacher ratio than you ever used to have, or I guess I should say smaller. It's more of a one-to-one, which that's eating up money that could probably be directed towards teachers. And something too, I was a teacher in a private Christian school in Indiana, so I know, mm-hmm. and believe you, talk about not getting paid well. I did not get paid well, but
right.
I would have loved to have what public school teachers made, but you know, some right. school districts like Des Moines pays their teachers well. Some rural school districts
right.
don't because they just don't have the tax base.
Right.
I guess, you know, I'm trying to, is there a question here?
let me jump in here, Shane. You touched
okay.
on a very good point because those small private schools or those small Christian schools run probably so much more efficiently. They probably, and I'm just pulling numbers out of the air, but they can probably teach a student for $8,000 to $10,000 per year, and you look at the public schools, and it's costing, you know, double that. It's probably costing $16,000 to $20,000 a year,
right,
and that's
right.
because of what you just said earlier, is that these there's way too many administrator type people in the system that are, you know, collecting salaries or being paid, and they're not directly involved with teaching the student.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, as far as how can that be addressed as a federal issue, it probably shouldn't be. But, you know,
mm-hmm.
one thing you were talking about, you know, loan repayments or loan forgiveness, since
right.
I think there actually are federal programs for that in some school districts working with high-risk
mm-hmm.
urban settings. But from an Iowa
right.
perspective,
I've heard that.
Yeah, from an Iowa perspective, we know that those teachers in rural school districts are getting paid less than the urban districts. You know, maybe
right.
there could be, you know, if we're going to be having federal funds for education, maybe something can be directed for loan forgiveness for teachers going into a small school district. I don't know, just a thought.
You bet. Yeah,
so,
I think that's a good idea.
Okay.
Yes.
I do have them every once
right.
in a while. So.
Okay.
Okay, I think as far as federal role, you and I are in the same sheet of music. As far as education is concerned, they shouldn't be.
Right.
Yes. You on your website, you talk about healthcare. Talk to me about your healthcare plan.
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, we just need to tackle the rising cost of healthcare and making insurance more affordable for everybody. Couple of solutions that I've heard out there, I think are good, or, you know, to expand access to group insurance plans and also allow for greater use of health savings accounts. They're called HSAs. My wife
yep.
and I have used HSAs. You know, that basically just puts us you know, back in charge of our own healthcare decisions, and it lowers monthly premiums and other healthcare costs. This talk about, you know, Medicare for all, or, you know, turning more of our healthcare system over to the government is just, would be a disaster. I mean, we've already seen, you know, how our federal government, you know, is not really efficient when it comes to spending. And so I was down in Des Moines speaking with one of the major clinics down there, surgical facility, talking to one of the doctors and the CEO. And what I took away from that conversation, Shane, is that if the patient doesn't understand, you know, how they're getting their care and how the care is being paid for, the system needs work. And so, you know, the smoke and mirrors with the big hospitals and the insurance companies needs to be looked at, and so that the, you know, the patient can get the care they need and know the costs of who's paying for it and how it's being paid. It's just, and one other example they gave me was, you know, some of these big hospitals originally were nonprofits. Okay, they were set up for the, you know, the help the medical community, and but now they've turned into big profit centers, and there's, just like the education, there's layers and layers of administrative help in there that, you know, we need to get back to just, you know, the core, how they were started was as a nonprofit rather than in these big money-making machines.
Okay, so that would translate into what, as far as in terms of what kind of legislation?
Well, the insurance companies, we just have to streamline the insurance companies so that there's more disclosure and more transparency on them. Now, how that translates in the legislation, I don't have answers right now, but I can tell you, just like in my business, Shane, I would hire professionals and experts. If I was going to go in and do a new real estate development, I'd go check, find out who's the best engineers in that area, who the best soils guy is in that area, and some of the best contractors, most, and use that expertise to build a project. And it's no different. I don't see any reason why I can't use that same model in legislation. Hire the doctor that knows the business, hospital person that has been involved with, you know, hospital, both running the facility and administratively and the physical plant, hiring those people to say, how can we run this more efficiently? And I'm sure there's professionals in the insurance field that you can find that aren't all about profits, that want to just serve their clients. And those are the people that we need to streamline it, make better decisions.
Okay, so, but in terms of overall policy goals, just to, you know, increase access to group medical plans, what would that look like?
Right.
Say I'm self-employed. So how, it under a reader healthcare plan, what would access to a group plan look like for me?
Well, I would think that my wife and I have been always had to get our own insurance. I've never worked for a company where I had health benefits. So okay, we've actually, just the last few years, most of our medical, we pay out of pocket. We have what we call, I think they're called co-ops, or like Liberty Health Share, or
You pay a monthly fee, and then people in the group help cover different medical bills. Yeah.
Right. So, you know, we have a very high deductible, and I think our, you know, it's mostly just for catastrophic type emergencies, but I think we pay $500-$600 a year. Everything else we pay out of pocket. We have kind of a mentality where it's wellness care. We, you know, try to eat right and go to doctors or DOs or homeopathic doctors that, you know, really help us, our health. And so something along the lines of these co-ops, I think, that we're involved, like Liberty Health Share. I'm not promoting them by any means. That's just one that we've used. And that just share the costs of medical, and then they watch it very closely. I think there's been a couple instances where we've used it, and my wife had to talk to them about, well, you cover this or that, so I would think something, a model along those lines would be better. Yes.
Okay. And you're talking, you also address in your website here, keeping medical clinics and hospitals in rural communities open, you know, is critical. What can be done to address the decline of, you know, physicians and rural healthcare clinics in not just Iowa, but, you know, rural America?
Right. Okay, so here's what I'm hearing. I'm trying to get all the best information so I can, offer some help or some suggestions along this line. But so we've got, I think they call it critical access care, okay, in some of these rural hospitals. Now, some of these hospitals get, these rural ones, they get some additional funding from the county. So taxpayers' monies that go into the county coffers helps out some of these hospitals. Some of them get no county, just like community hospitals, like in a small town. And I think, you know, you have to have that critical access care for a trauma situation. You know, someone has a heart attack, somebody breaks a leg, or there's some business, someone gets hurt on a business, where they have to get immediately into a hospital within, you know, 5 to 15, 20 minutes so that they can get that immediate care. We have to protect that critical access care.
Right.
And the specialists, but, you know, people, and they're used to doing it now, the people in the rural areas, if you're suffering from cancer or you need a new hip or you need some type of heart procedure, you know, those are obviously, you can have to drive to the larger metropolitan areas in our district. It's, you know, Des Moines or Sioux Falls or Omaha to get that care, or Sioux City to get that care. So I think protecting these small rural hospitals and keeping that critical access care is very important. And then just concentrating more on just general well care, you know, family physicians that are able to serve those local communities, and let the specialists in the major hospitals and clinics serve the planned surgeries and those types of things. So that's yeah.
Tonight, and just this podcast will actually probably go out tomorrow, but tonight, Thursday, the CNN's having a town hall with the different Democratic presidential candidates, or forum, actually,
right.
On LGBT issues. And one of the plans that I've seen a couple different things I've seen in Congress get passed by the House, one is the Equality Act. That would add sexual orientation and gender identity to various civil rights laws currently, in the federal code, and make them protected classes. Also, there's a bill out there I think was passed by the House called the Do No Harm Act, Both the Equality Act and the Do No Harm Act both basically gut or nullify the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. So I guess I wanted to ask you, you got two compelling liberty interests. You've got the LGBT crowd that wants to make sure they're not discriminated against with housing, with employment, with getting bank loans and a whole variety of different things. But then on the other hand too, you've got Christians who don't want to be compelled to, say, provide services for a same-sex marriage or a pride event. How do you balance those compelling interests? How do you protect religious liberty while still respecting, you know, people who want to make sure they have employment, for instance?
Right. Well, good question. Okay, so I'm for less regulation, and I believe that the federal government does not need to be involved in these issues. I believe that these are personal issues that I have no problem with people that have different sexual orientation or different religious beliefs. I believe most Americans, I mean, we've come a long way, and I think that most Americans do not discriminate, and that there are a small percentage, and that these are all personal decisions that should be made. The federal government doesn't need to be involved in making law that should be kept between individuals and their church. And I have a daughter that is studying psychology. She's in her last year of graduate school, and she's been absolutely immersed. She's at Columbia University. It's in New York City, and she's been immersed in this type of discussion. And she's been a good conduit for me to help me understand and have compassion for these folks. But I still, Shane, struggle with the federal government stepping in we already have, let me just back up. We have our forefathers wrote the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution that protects people. And that document needs to be dusted off. As a matter of fact, I hand these out when I'm on the campaign trail. I've got these pocket constitutions. I go, I stand by this, okay? And it gives individuals freedoms and liberties to, and we don't need to start rewriting that document, Shane. If somebody has a business and, you know, take the baker in Colorado, if he's got a business and he feels that that's it, you know, if someone comes in with an order that he feels is infringing on his religious beliefs, he should have the option to say whether or not he's going to produce a cake for that individual. That gay couple that come in, or they can buy any cake that they want and take it home and decorate it the way they want. But right. To tell him that he has to run his business to meet their personal beliefs, whether they have sexual orientation or religious, he should have that choice to make. And I stand behind that baker in Colorado too. He's been unduly attacked by a liberal left that want to tell him, impose their beliefs and tell him how to run his business.
More illiberal than liberal left, it seems like. It seems like the Democratic Party is by and large jettisoning classic liberalism.
Right. Anyway. Right. I agree. And it's just, I have compassion for people that, are struggling with, sexual abuse or their sexual orientation. And, it's unfortunate that they may feel that they feel left out. But I say, I just refer to the U.S. Constitution. It they're protected in there. They can do what they want. Anyhow, I'm starting to ramble, but.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah. I'll keep it moving here. I know Congressman Steve King was one of the primary authors of the Heartbeat abortion ban legislation that on the federal level, but that was used as a model for different state laws, including Iowa's. I just wanted I'm sure our listeners would like to know, where do you stand on the life issue? Do you support heartbeat legislation? Do you support personhood, or are you more incremental when it comes to life?
I absolutely am pro-life. I believe that the heartbeat bill was a good bill that was passed. And just like you're seeing, Shane, all over the country, you see people vote for something. You see duly elected legislators pass something. And then you see it overturned by a court or some liberal group or some group that wants to try to legislate from the bench. And that's how my understanding, I don't know if you know Maggie DeWitt, Iowans for Life, she gave us a quick little crash course on how that was overturned, which I don't agree with. And so now she's working diligently to try to get an amendment to the Iowa Constitution so that we can, make it law.
Yeah,
the
constitutional amendment in question, just for our listeners, is basically adding to the Iowa Constitution language that says that this nowhere in this Constitution conveys the right to abortion or abortion funding. My paraphrase, but that's essentially what it does.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily ban abortion. It doesn't ban abortion, but it takes the argument that there's a constitutional right to abortion found in the Iowa Constitution. So.
Right. Yeah. So I'm a firm believer that I'm pro-life, that, life begins at conception, and that, we don't have a right to end a life, an unborn life. And I think that if we need to spend any monies, it needs to be for helping that woman, help her understand what a huge decision that is, whether it be through some type of therapy or counseling or whatever, to help that woman work through an unplanned pregnancy. I would rather see the money spent on that than, toward abortion.
Okay. I want to move on here because we're starting to already go along, and there's a couple other questions I want to ask you. Immigration is a huge issue in the Iowa's 4th Congressional District in particular, but among Republicans in general.
Right.
What's your view of immigration reform, border security? Is there any middle ground that can be found with Democrats to bring about, a comprehensive immigration bill?
Well, I believe in legal immigration. I hear these stories all the time about people that want to take the legal path, how long it takes them. It takes too long. I have talked firsthand with a couple people that have immigrated legally, and I think that we need to, there's no way we can have open borders. We need to secure our border and, mm-hmm. and streamline the legalization process. And that once again, that's something that I would hope that if, when I go to Washington, that I could help negotiate that and walk across the aisle and say, look, you know, we need to streamline the process. Right now, the way I understand it is, you know, Trump, they're just fighting Trump with his efforts to streamline the process because they just don't want to work with him or they don't want to give him a win. So I would hope that I would be able to walk across the aisle and negotiate on both sides, those Republicans, those Democrats that might be struggling with trying to streamline the process, because it just has to be streamlined. I mean, Iowa has one of the lowest unemployment rates around. We need workers here. We need good quality legal immigration so that if people want to come and work, they're should be entitled to. That's what this country is all about.
Okay, just a kind of a follow-up. Congressman mm-hmm. King opposes the basically DACA for minor children, the delayed, I can't remember what DACA stands for now. It's not, you know, deporting children of those who delayed action on childhood arrivals. That's what DACA stands for. Do you support basically, I guess, allowing children of immigrants who came here illegally, across the border illegally, the opportunity to stay if they came across the border as a minor?
I would probably be in support of working towards some type of work with them to grant them citizenship, but I really don't think they should go through any other process than what if someone were to come across tomorrow or come to our country tomorrow and wanted to become a legalized citizen. I don't think the process should really be that different. I mean, just because they've been here for, you know, 5, 10, 15 years mm-hmm. shouldn't give them an advantage over somebody that wants to come from another country next week. The whole process just needs to be streamlined, and I'm sure there's plenty of people that are in this DACA group or this DACA program that could be add a tremendous asset to our citizenship and our workforce, but we just have to streamline the process. It's just
sure.
Okay.
President Trump recently made the decision to pull troops out of Syria to make
right.
way for, you know, Turkish military action against the Kurds in Syria. How mm-hmm. do you if you're elected to Congress, that's what's your view of basically
right.
that particular action, as well as just our military involvement in different countries? How do you think we should
right.
approach that?
Well, I agree with Trump that we need to be pulling those troops out of the Middle East, and I don't like the idea of these, you know, neocons thinking, you know, that we have to be there I think there's enough intelligence around the world to know that if they're doing some bad things in other parts of the country, that is a threat to our national defense, the United States, that we could work to try to squelch that. But to have the troops over there, and here's my thoughts on that, Shane. It's such a double standard, because we had considered, Turkey an ally, okay?
Right.
And then, and so now they're saying, oh, my gosh, you know, we have to go protect the church, and I'm thinking, well, wait a minute. We were, and I don't know if we were given military aid to Turkey, may have, but it's, I don't know, the thought that we have to stay over there in this conflicted area when I don't think it is hurting or it's having an impact on the United States sovereignty. We need to bring, you know, those kids home and just continue to just protect our sovereignty here for the United States. So that's how I feel about that.
Okay. And last question. I hope by the time 2020 comes around that this whole impeachment thing is over, but in case it's not and you have to deal with an impeachment inquiry, what's your thoughts on the whole impeachment inquiry as well as the whistleblower report, President Trump asking foreign leaders to help with investigating, you know, the Bidens?
Right.
What's your view?
My view, Shane, is that this is nothing more than an attempt by the Democrats, a very liberal media, to overturn an election of our president. They have been fighting with him and trying to take him out from day one. And if you look at his core agenda and his core beliefs about what he's trying to do for America and the economy that we're in right now, he is doing a decent job. We can all sit back and debate about his tweets and the things he says. Trump is a promoter. He's a developer. He's going to come up with grandiose ideas or outlandish statements that people want to think that he's promoting our country and he's promoting business. And I don't agree with all this impeachment business. It's just I've tried to listen intently to find out what some of these Democrats on either side, how they're proposing to pass just decent legislation, everything from, better, like we were talking earlier on immigration reform, but they're more focused on taking out Trump than they are helping the people that they represent. And that's what I'm hoping that I can go and help in Washington just to try to add just a non-political my experience in business to try to help the situation. So that's my feelings on impeachment. Waste of time.
Okay. Two quick last questions, and I'll let you go.
Yeah.
One, this is the caffeinated thought. They're easy, not policy related, just fun questions. This is the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. So what's your favorite source of caffeine?
Well, haven't been a big caffeine drinker. We like to drink teas at our house. But I was wrapping up a project in Colorado where I was immersing myself into the community to make sure I got all the right contractors and everybody, and was at the Java Lava with all the contractors every morning. So I had a little bit of caffeine there, but for the most part, I'm not a big coffee drinker. I don't even have a coffee maker in my house. So usually when I'm out with, usually when I'm out with my friends or meeting somebody for a business meeting, I enjoy a good cup of coffee. Absolutely, but not a regular drinker.
So also. You grew up in Nebraska, so I'm assuming you're a Cornhusker fan. I don't know, Steve. That might disqualify you, man.
Well, I did go to the University of Nebraska, And it's hard not to root for the Huskers once in a while, although they've had some tough years. But
I'm sorry about that. I will pray for you.
Thank you. Thank you. Iowa State's in my district, so I've been my cousin and went to Iowa State, and so I have lots of cousins that went to Iowa State, so that's my home favorite is the Cyclones, so that's who I root for.
Okay. And just want to give you an opportunity, if there's anything else you want to share with our listeners that we didn't already discuss, give you you could do a short elevator speech.
Sure. Well, this election coming up in 2020 is very important on all levels of government. I feel that the Iowa's 4th Congressional District has to put the best candidate forward to meet the Democrats in 2020 in the general election. I feel like I fit that qualification with my business experience. I saw JD for the first time last night. He was up here in Dickinson County. I listened to him. I did not see a whole lot of substance there that was discussed in the meeting, but I feel like that if this seat goes to the Democrats, it'll be more of just what we're seeing today in Washington, and not a lot of representation of the good Iowa Midwestern values that I treasure. And I feel like I have a very good chance of holding on to our conservative values that most Northwest Iowans, whether you're Republican or Democrat, that we treasure, that I can carry those forward if I'm elected in 2020.
Okay, and where can people learn more about your campaign?
Okay, so we have a website that just got up and running, because I just announced like 10 or 11 days ago. Mm-hmm. Reader for Congress, www.readerforcongress.com. My tremendous wife, Brenda, and my daughter Emily and my daughter Anna have been doing a great job of helping me, since I'm a 59-year-old dinosaur, help me with social media. They're doing a good job of keeping me out there on that. And we've got some more good videos and YouTube videos coming up. And I look forward to meeting as many people as I can throughout the 39 counties of this district.
All right. Well, Steve, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Shane, thank you very much. And keep up the good work. Caffeinated Thoughts is doing an awesome job, and we appreciate that.
And that concludes today's episode of the Caffeinated Thoughts podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you happen to be listening to this podcast somewhere other than on our website, please be sure to check out caffeinatedthoughts.com. Again, that's caffeinatedthoughts.com, or you could just Google Caffeinated Thoughts, and it'll show up at the top of your search screen. Also, be sure to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for emails. That way you don't miss a single update. And you can listen to this podcast, if you happen to be listening to it on the website, you can listen to our podcast and subscribe to it through a variety of ways. For instance, Apple Podcasts. If you subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and you like this podcast, please be sure to give us a 5-star rating. If you hate this podcast, just forget you ever heard this. I'd appreciate it. No, I hope that you do rate us on Apple Podcasts. Also, we're on Spotify, we're on Stitcher, we're on Podbean, we're on SoundCloud. I don't think I'm missing anybody. If there is a podcast service or app that you'd like to see us on that we're not currently on, drop me a line at shane@caffeinatedthoughts.com, and I'll try to make that happen. I hope you appreciated this conversation with Steve Reeder and you found it informative. I'm trying to get all the candidates in Iowa's 4th Congressional District in. I've talked with Congressman Steve King before in the past, but I do want to get him back on the podcast. Also, I have not talked with Brett Richards, and my goal is to get him on the podcast as well. That way we've had a chance to interview everybody. and hopefully help you if you live in the 4th District to make an informed decision. Also would like to get, you know, other candidates on in other congressional districts as well. So that's my goal as well, state legislative candidates and other candidates down the road as we head towards 2020. So hopefully, my friends, you like this episode, and I hope you have a great weekend. Take care of yourselves. I'll see you next time. This is Shane Vanderhart signing off.